our resilient economy.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Despite the housing market, despite the credit turmoil on Wall Street, the U.S. economy keeps chugging along. This morning, the government said GDP grew at 3.9% in the third quarter. That's quite a bit more than economists expected, and it's the fastest growth in 18 months. Two things helped. Consumers picked up their spending, and American companies sold more goods overseas. Now for the bad news. The dollar is getting weaker and weaker. It hit another record low against the euro today. For a British pound, it now costs $2.07. Traders are selling dollars because they expect the Fed to cut interest rates today. Let's get a European perspective on this from our man in London, Stephen Beard. Stephen, first of all, what's the relationship between interest rates and the currencies?
As interest rates come down, of course, a currency becomes less attractive to international investors. They earn less money holding that currency, and therefore they tend to pull out and put it into another currency, in particular the British pound, because while U.S. interest rates are 4.75% and falling in the U.K., they are 5.75% and very likely to stay at that level into the new year.
Are people in Britain happy with this situation, with a strong pound and a weak dollar?
Anybody planning a visit to the U.S. is certainly happy. It's good for British companies importing products from the U.S. and buying raw materials on the world market, generally denominated in U.S. dollars. But, of course, it is bad for British exporters.
Stephen, how long do you think this is going to go on? Are we talking 3-1, 4-1, 5-1?
Well, there are some analysts here saying that the British economy is beset by many of the same problems as the U.S. economy, such as a big trade deficit, inflated house prices, and they reckon it won't be long before these begin to take their toll on the British pound, and it could indeed fall back below $2 early next year.
Good, because I'd love to come visit, but I can't afford it, Stephen.
Well, maybe next year.
All right. Stephen Beard, our correspondent in London. Thanks.
Okay, Scott.
The Fed makes its decision about interest rates today at 2:15 Eastern Time. So far, the Dow is up 21 points to 13,814. The NASDAQ has gained 6. The S&P 500 is up 5 points. The Asian markets were little changed by their close. European shares are about a third of a percent higher. The U.S. government's Do Not Call list seems to work. If you sign up, usually those dinnertime telemarketing interruptions stop. But before the government started its list, there were dozens of ways to opt out, and none of them seemed to work. So today, some online privacy groups are going to try the one list approach with online marketing. Steve Henn reports on what's being called the Do Not Track list.
Right now, online advertisers track detailed information about the behavior of internet users. In some cases, they combine that with individual names, and they can do all of this without you ever knowing. Mark Rottenberg is at the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
Users should see the data that's being collected and how it's being used.
But they don't. Instead, Americans can opt out of being tracked online by signing up for lists. AOL announced its own opt-out list today. There's another for network advertisers. But privacy advocates say none of these lists work very well. Ari Schwartz is at the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Right now, too many people feel that their information is just completely out of their control. And the privacy discussion is really about putting individuals back in control of their information.
So today, Schwartz's group and a half dozen others will ask the FTC to take the lead and create one place all Americans can go if they want to protect their privacy online. Rottenberg says the FTC should go further and require companies to tell Americans exactly what they're up to. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Singapore Airlines has outfitted its new Airbus A380 with sleeping cabins and double beds. This is that gigantic plane that can seat 500 people. Well, Singapore is telling people not to get the wrong idea in those cabins. It has banned romantic relations. If couples decide they want to join the Mile High Club, the airline says it will ask them to desist. You're listening to the Morning Report for Wednesday, October 31st on marketplace.org. Do a company's decisions on dealing with climate change have an effect on the bottom line? You'd think so. Now, should shareholders be warned about that? Well, it depends on who you ask. Congress takes a look at this issue today. Jeremy Hobson has more from Washington.
On one side is Mindy Luber, the president of Ceres, a coalition of investors and environmentalists. She'll testify to Congress today that the Securities and Exchange Commission isn't doing its job.
Right now, the law says that the SEC should require publicly traded companies to disclose any material risk. For dozens of industries, climate change creates that risk.
For instance, she says, the impact of mega hurricanes on insurance companies or the impact of carbon caps on power companies planning to build coal plants. But Rajiv Dhawan, an economic forecaster at Georgia State University, says the risk can't be easily quantified.
Climate change is governed by so many different things, so it should not be the responsibility of the company. The investors have to do their due diligence.
Whatever Congress does, Mindy Luber is hedging her bets. She'll meet with the SEC about the issue in December. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Westerners once poured into China, eager for adventure and business opportunities. But they're being replaced by a new breed of transplant, corporate managers and their families who don't really want to be in China. Bill Marcus reports from Shanghai on this crowd of unwilling expats.
China often reminds you you're not in charge. Make a mistake when you dial an international call and you get this response.
You're not authorized to dial this number.
The Chinese have had thousands of years to feel powerless. Jocelyn Lamila's had 7 months. That's how long it's been since her husband transferred to Shanghai. A few weeks ago, Lamila had some furniture delivered.
I saw them opening the back of the van to get the furniture out, so I opened the door and I waited for them. And one of the men went around the side of the van in my front yard and peed in the front yard.
For Jocelyn, who's from Ohio, China is an unwelcome adventure. It's hard to get around. The people are crude, and she can't speak the language. It's nothing like her family's last posting in Zurich. But she and her husband Yari, a controller for a multinational company, knew that when they were asked to move to China, they really had no choice.
You sort of have to have a China in your CV to get somewhere in a company.
ChinaSolve.com publisher Andrew Hubert says there are hundreds of families like the Lamilas.
The dominant model in China right now is the expat who doesn't really want to be here or doesn't really care about being in China per se. He would rather stay home.
Big companies are doing what they have long done to help these people adjust, including recreating Main Street.
They've got American stores, American restaurants, American-style housing, American-style hospitals and medical facilities, American-style schools, and they have spent a lot of money. Someone has spent a lot of money replicating the American lifestyle.
But soon there may be fewer Americans to appreciate it. Global companies are finding they get the same talent for less money by hiring locally. And, given a fatter paycheck, the Chinese will suffer powerlessness gladly. In Shanghai, I'm Bill Marcus for Marketplace.
For kids, too much Halloween candy equals stomach ache and, of course, cavities. Dentists are always warning kids about this, but, you know, it goes in one ear and out the other. But money, now money talks, even to children. Here's Renita Jablonski.
Dr. Chris Kammer was sick of sending out the same old press release about the not-so-sweet effect of candy on teeth. He wanted to find another way to drill home that message.
Halloween, you know, the holiday that all dentists should dread, will now be the holiday that dentists will take back.
Cameron decided to buy back the Halloween candy of kids in his Wisconsin neighborhood. For every pound, he handed over a dollar. He gave away more than $250 in '06 and sent the candy to U.S. troops in Iraq. Around 200 dental offices will give it a shot this year. Jody Sullivan is helping with the program in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Her office ordered hundreds of lightsaber toothbrushes as an extra bonus.
I know all kids might not want to give up their candy, so there has to be a little bit of incentive, I guess.
Cammer says along with toothbrushes, he'll have plenty of singles ready for tomorrow's buyback.
I want to have $1,000 in cash.
Hope the tooth fairy's listening. I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
I was thinking of dressing up this Halloween as an arm and a leg, because that's how much Halloween costumes seem to cost these days. Commentator David Frum has been scouring for an economic explanation.
In an old family photo album, there is a picture of my sister and myself on our way to our first Halloween. She's carrying a fairy wand, a drumstick wrapped in tinfoil. I've pulled on a football helmet and rain boots to be a spaceman. We're both holding paper loot bags. Total cash expenditure? Not quite zero, since my sister used actually quite a lot of tinfoil, but close to it. Flash forward. Halloween today ranks as the fourth most lavish national holiday event, behind Christmas, the Super Bowl, and New Year's Eve. Almost half of American adults expect to spend money to decorate their homes in some way. A half century ago, the liberal economist John Kenneth Galbraith argued that consumer behavior is largely fomented by manipulative advertising. Big corporations instill in consumers desires that they would never otherwise feel. You can see the appeal of this theory. It avoids the embarrassing possibility that Americans have decided for themselves to turn their homes into backdrops for horror movies. But it's not big candy or the ghoul industry that drives the Halloween holiday. Some social critics think we are seeing the emergence of a new kind of half-grown-up, an infantilized society of kidults who read Harry Potter. That may be so, but I think there's a simpler explanation for the Halloween boom. The fastest growth in Halloween spending is occurring among college-age Americans. Halloween has evolved into a one-day spring break, conveniently placed almost exactly midway between the start of term and Christmas exams. The humor magazine, The Onion, published a joke list of the top holiday costumes for college-age women. Sexy French maid, sexy cat, sexy witch, sexy hobo, sexy ketchup bottle, and so on. And despite John Kenneth Galbraith, you don't need advertising to sell that.
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. If you'd like to argue about his Halloween theories, join us online at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening, and happy Halloween.
American Public Media.